2003 House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Welcome to you all. We are actually going to hear all three bills on our agenda today, which is a first for us over the last couple of weeks. And before we get started, of course, as I always do, is to call your attention that on the witness sign-up sheet, there is a little box there that talks about truthful testimony and accurate under the law if you are indeed a lobbyist or government official. If you are a member of the public at large, this does not apply to you, but of course, we still want you to be accurate and tell the truth. Thank you. And we are going to hear a House bill. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3102. Ray, tell us what this is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3102 rescinds Oregon's pesticide use reporting system. Mr. Chair, during the 99th session, House Bill 3602 was passed and it required the Oregon Department of Agriculture to establish and implement a pesticide use reporting system. It required the department to design, develop, and implement the system in order to collect, evaluate, summarize, retain, and report information on the use of pesticides in each major category of use in Oregon. Those categories include agriculture, forestry, industrial, urban, commercial, urban homeowner uses prescribed, and the measure prescribed minimum elements of the new reporting system and associated public education initiatives and grants. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Representative Crummell, welcome. Great to have you here today. And why don't you tell us why you're bringing this idea forward for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. And the reason why I brought this bill forward, Mr. Chair, is because I have a constituent who called it to my attention that we have a problem with the bill that was passed in 1999. And the biggest problem is that particularly with the folks that are working as applicators, these are the pest control companies that work in and around our state. And the reporting that they're having to do is creating quite a bit of problem from the standpoint that they're not able to necessarily always comply with the law in the way that they want to make sure that they do. Part of it has to do with the software, computer software programs that the department is utilizing. It's hard to get on. It's hard to stay on once it's not very user-friendly. And so this consequently creates quite a problem for them. And in terms of the reporting itself, the one fellow who you will receive have received testimony from, it's written testimony that was sent to me, he testified, would tell you if he were here, that it takes him anywhere from about 400 to 500 hours a year to comply with this law. Now that's quite a bit of time. That's with the folks that he has in the field, as well as himself. And when he tries to get onto the system, for example, he may have a half a day blocked out to go in and do the reporting for a particular month, and all of a sudden he can't get on the system, or he's on the system and gets kicked off the system and is unable to complete the report. So for the people that we have out there actually doing the work, what this has done is it has created quite a problem. And what I wanted to do, my first slide here, and this is my first attempt, and I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chair, at doing a high-tech kind of presentation for a committee. But I want to call your attention to the new statute that we passed in 1999, became Oregon Laws, 1059, or Chapter 1059 of Oregon Laws, 1999. And Section 4 lays out the establishment and implementation of the pesticide reporting, use reporting. And it talks about that it needs to be the quantity of the pesticide applied, the purpose of the application, when the month of the application, and then there's some other data that they're supposed to to do. And I would call your attention on the written copy that I sent out, or that I that I gave out to you. Chapter 634.146 of the Oregon Revised Statutes calls for records that are required to be kept. And you'll notice that it has the name of the person for whom the pesticide was applied and where it was applied at, and the date and approximate time, and the person who supplied the pesticides, and some of the other materials. So there actually is, in terms of what was in existing statute at the time that we passed Chapter 1059, and what we put into the statute, there's a lot of it is the same, and some of it is so we have some duplication there, and some of it is contradictory. And I just call that to your attention. So what we've sort of done to the folks that when we passed this in 1999, what we sort of did to them was we created a double work for them. And I don't think that's something, I think that that's kind of an unintended consequence, but that still is a consequence that we created. Now what I'd like to do is just show you a couple of slides on a PowerPoint presentation that was provided to me by my constituent, and if it will come up here, which it did, and I'll just go to the next. These are rodents, and these are mouse teeth, as you can see. And the purpose of showing you these slides is that the folks that are out there, and this is the fellow that has been talking to me, does pesticide control in restaurants and homes and other places, and this is the type of thing that we end up with if these people don't stay in business. I mean, this really is a public health issue from the standpoint of controlling the pests. And while it might be the desire to get rid of all of our pest control or our pesticides and our agents and that sort of thing, I think we have to remember that from a standpoint of a public health issue, it is important that we makes you want to run right out and go to the next restaurant, doesn't it? And I'm not trying to get on the restaurant industry here, because I think that they, for the most part, they try to keep things clean in their establishments. But it's important that they have these other businesses that they can rely on that will come in and help them control the pests that may infestate their places of business, so that their establishments remain clean and remain a safe place for us to go out and dine in. And so I just bring this to your attention. These are some of the things that these folks, when they go out to these facilities, might see, and what kind of a danger it is to the buying public. And I'm going to just kind of whip through the rest of these here, because they're just sort of bugs and all kinds of little junk that you might see. And
I'm glad this was after lunch,
yeah.
Representative.
Well, you know, I know. It makes you want to run right up to the, let's see, end of slide slow, click to exit. There we go. Okay. So I just wanted to use that as a pretty graphic way of introducing to you and showing to you, Mr. Chair, the necessity of having these businesses out there that are trying to comply with the law but are finding it very difficult for a variety of reasons. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate, as I mentioned, the indulgence, and I will close. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that there are portions of this particular law that we passed in 99 that is actually duplicative of other statutes.
Right.
Do you think that since those other statutes are on the books, that we ought to keep, in your concept, we ought to keep those original statutes on the books also?
Yes, in the original, in my concept is that we would keep the statute in 634 that we have, because it already describes what is supposed to be done and how it's supposed to be accomplished and that sort of thing, and we would take out what we passed in 1999.
Okay. Members, questions of Representative Crummel? Representative Hunt.
Thank you. Always good to see my colleague from Clackamas County. I guess I would ask, and not having been here for the session when this was passed, but I assume there were a whole variety of concerns that came up that provided the impetus for passing that in the first place. Is your sense that the other statutes, which were previously put on the books, address all of the concerns that were raised in the context of passing passing these reporting provisions in 99?
I think that, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, thank you for the question. I think that at the time that we passed the pesticide use reporting, I think that we thought that it was a good idea and that it was a necessity. And I think what we have come to find is that it really has ended up being an additional layer of government for these businesses that are out there trying to comply, and that probably what we had on the books already was sufficient. I'm sure that there's going to be folks that are going to disagree with me on that, and they're probably going to come up and testify and say that, no, we absolutely need to have this program. I'm not so sure that we do. I mean, I guess where we could go from here if repealing what we passed in 99 was unpalatable to this committee and to the chamber, then maybe where we could go would be to figure out what it is that was duplicative and take that out, and what was not duplicative but is necessary and leave that in, and then instruct the agency to move forward from a standpoint of making sure that people that are supposed to comply with this law can actually get to the software, they can actually do the things that they're supposed to be able to do in terms of reporting, and that we don't make reporting very onerous. One of the complaints in the metro area that you will hear from these businesses that provide this service is the fact that because it's by zip code, you might have a person who has, for example, Quality Pest Control, which is a company that David Liddell, my constituent, has been works for. One of the things that you'll find with him is that he might have a person out in the field, one of his employees out in the field, who is in five different time zones, or five different zip codes within one day. He's working in that many places, and he has to make sure that he does the reporting for each one of those zip codes. You know, when you're out in Eastern Oregon, it's one thing. You've got, you know, 40 miles in one zip code. When you're in the metro area or Eugene area or even the Salem area, you've got 40 miles and you've got about 30 zip codes. So there's a huge difference in terms of how you're working on the reporting.
Thank you. And you'll probably be pleased to know we actually had a hearing, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago that talked specifically about some of the mechanisms for reporting and the need to provide some paperwork options for whatever reporting we have, recognizing that some people don't have technology and that's
right.
We just can't assume that. I guess the one other question I would have would be, because I think we all acknowledge that 400 or 500 hours a year of reporting to comply with this is insanity. At least that's my perspective.
Yes.
I wonder, has there been some kind of pushing on that to get a sense of how that breaks down? I'm wondering if that's a way to help get at what some of the more onerous, difficult parts of the law as it is now may be, so we can zero in on those areas. Because I guess, I mean, my personal perspective is just concerned about wholesale rescinding of it.
Sure. Hi, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt. I guess what I really wanted to do was get the conversation started, and sometimes in this building, repealing is a bill to repeal something is sometimes the best way to get an actual conversation going. I think that there probably is some middle ground that we can reach, but I think that there's a couple of things. One is that we've got to find out from the agency what they can actually support from a standpoint of budgetary constraints. If they can't support it and we're not going to be able to do it right, then what we really ought to do is we either ought to eliminate it or we ought to delay it. And if we are going to delay it, then work with the agency in terms of how they're going to be able to construct this thing, how they're going to be able to have the software in place so that we don't have this onerousness onerousness on our businesses that are out there, you know, trying to comply with the law while also protecting the public health.
Further questions, yes, Representative Byer.
Yes. Good afternoon, Representative Cromwell. And you talk about duplication. I think the one thing that my concern about is that what's there doesn't really require reporting. It requires record keeping, but not reporting of where the pesticides are used. So there is no duplication of that piece of it, which is actually the title of the law, the pesticide reporting piece. So do you have a...
Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, thank you for the question. Yes, actually, I think that because we had many, we have many of the you know, the companies are supposed to be recording and keeping track of what they're utilizing. Turning that into a report, I think, is one thing. Having, making them or forcing them to do and to, in order to comply with this, to fill out a whole different set of forms and a, you know, that sort of thing, I think that's where part of the rub comes. We need to figure out a way that we can, that these companies, when they're, they've got to keep records of what it is they use, being able to turn those records into a report without making it this onerous process for them to go through.
Follow?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I also was not here during this discussion and hadn't listened to it. So the record keeping that had been required before, is this, besides the fact that they are now required to enter this online, is this totally different? I mean, are we requiring them to do this record keeping and then another set of record keeping?
Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, basically yes. That's precisely what we're requiring them to do. Is it's a different format. It's a different form. It's and to be able to do it online is a because of the way the software is set up, is that it's not necessarily user friendly. Well, it's not user friendly. That's part of the problem. And getting access into the system is not very easy. So yes, they have one set of records that they have to keep, and then they have whatever they have to do in terms of for the reporting itself, and we need to figure out a way to meld those two together. And I don't think, quite frankly, I don't think the businesses that are doing this have a problem with reporting, and I don't think they have a problem with record keeping. I think what they have a problem with is that we basically have two different systems that they have to comply with, and they're sincerely trying to comply with this, but it has become very onerous for them to be able to do it.
Yeah, yes. Questions. And I guess my other concern is, I don't know whether I'd say this is a concern, but do you think this is something that we need? I mean, do you think that it's important for us to keep track of where pesticides are being used? And would this, by getting rid of it, not kind of hurt that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Byer, that's a very good question. Is it important for us to know where the pesticides are being used? I don't know. I guess in 99, because I supported the bill in 99 when it came across the floor. I guess it's one of those. I thought it was a good idea at the time. And I think that there's a lot of things that we might at the time think that are good ideas, and to find out later that they're not really all they're cracked up to be. I think that if keeping records on pesticides and where they're being used and how they're being used and whether they're being used correctly and that sort of thing helps us from a standpoint of protecting our streams and protecting our watersheds and protecting our forests and that sort of thing, then yes, I think that can be very worthwhile. I think that if it's to try to be ornery and make it tough for these businesses to comply with, and if it's just meant to, well, basically, if it's meant to drive the pesticide industry, if you will, out of business, then I think that's a misappropriation. I think that's inappropriate use of government, and I think that's a hammer that we don't want to have, because as you saw from the slides that I presented, the public health issues, I think, are something that we need help with as well. And as much as restaurants are trying to, they try to do the right thing by keeping pests out of their establishments, there are some cases where they're going to be there, and they need the help of these companies in order to be able to keep control of those pests.
Thank you. Just a little quick clarification.
One more?
Sorry.
Representative Biker.
In that answer, I'm trying to figure out whether you're, in your mind, what we're doing is using it as a hammer, as instead of just trying to protect our environment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, at this point, I would say that's all we're doing, is using it as a hammer, as opposed to using it as a way of protecting our environment. And the other thing is that by just layering on more things for these companies to do. You know, I mean, for example, this fellow has a choice of hiring another person in the field or complying with the law. Well, it ends up being, I've got to comply with this law, so I'm going to do that. So he may not be able to hire another person in the field.
Thank you, and thank you for indulging me.
Certainly. Other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and again, thank you for your indulgence.
And Matt Blevins.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council, also here representing OPEN, the Oregon Pesticide Education Network. Honored to be back here in front of the committee to talk about the Pesticide Use Reporting Program, which is always a very fun thing to discuss, and looking forward to having more of this discussion. I think that it's clear that there is a lot more need to understand exactly where things are going with the Pesticide Use Reporting Program and how we're going to make the best use of the program and make sure it serves everybody's purposes. I think that kind of discussion can continue to happen, and we can figure out how to improve upon a system that is just barely getting off the ground as is. But I just want to make a couple of points for the committee. One, I think, again, trying to look at rolling back this program would be undercutting the public trust in the legislature, and particularly around this program. There was overwhelming support for this program when it was passed in 1999. In fact, it passed out 88-2. And there has not been a push by the public to try to roll this program back. So I would encourage the committee not to take that type of action right now. There's been the Representative Crummell raised a number of concerns that his constituent has about this program, and I guess I have those questions about where some of those are coming from. I still am unclear what current regulations would provide the same type of information that the Pesticide Use Reporting Program does provide. The reason and the impetus for this program was that there isn't clear data available to the public about what pesticide use is here in Oregon. And there's a real desire by researchers across the state to be able to have access to the good information to be able to protect public health and be able to have a better idea of, is there an impact from pesticides that we should be aware of and we should be working to deal with? We don't have that information right now, and this program is supposed to provide that. The other issue is that to try to talk about rolling this program or eliminating this program at this point before it's really had a chance to get off the ground seems to be premature. Reporters, people, users of pesticides only started reporting their information at the beginning of last year. We, in fact, haven't even seen the first full report from the department about pesticide use, and so to eliminate this program before that's even gotten a chance to go forward seems, again, to be premature. This program, we think, again, would be very valuable for public health. I'm sure you'll hear testimony today from public health officials talking about the needs and the uses for this type of data. We agree with that. We also think that this is actually going to be good for business. And, in fact, the handout that I handed out is a letter to the editor that was written by Pat Dudley, who's on the Department of Ag Department of Ag Board, and he just sent this into the Oregonian, talking about the opportunities there are for business to use this to help their niche marketing and to move forward in economic development using this type of a program. So we would encourage the committee to look at it in that context. There's some real opportunities here in foreign markets to be able to use this to help market Oregon products, Oregon agricultural products. We agree that there's some challenges right now with the program. Because of the delay in providing full funding to the department, it's been a real stop-and-go process. The full permanent system that's supposed to make it easier for folks to report isn't up on and online yet, and that has been a challenge for folks. And we would encourage the legislature and the committee to find a way to make sure that that program can get up and running as soon as possible and make it as easy as possible for folks to file their information. If we can do paper reporting and make that easier, we support that. Anything that's going to make the process easier for users is something that we'd be willing to work towards. So we'd encourage folks to look at those different options that are out there. I think, again, really what it comes down to is money for the program. That's why we've been delayed on the program, and that's, I think, a big question as we move forward. We'd encourage the committee and the legislature to look at ways to creatively fund this program and move forward with implementing this and make sure that the program works before reassessing its effectiveness. Again, there's other options out there besides general fund, whether it's a pesticide dealer fee or other options on the table. We're open to having those conversations, but we'd encourage the committee to look at those first. So with that, again, just would encourage the committee to not take this drastic step, to look at the program in a more comprehensive way and to figure out a way that we can implement this program in a timely manner to serve the public health. Thanks. I'll take questions.
Questions?
Can I? I'll do it again. Sorry. I'll be very brief this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your mind, are the two what the users were keeping records on before and what they're having to do now, are they really two separate pieces?
My understanding is, yes, they are two separate pieces. And, again, the department may be able to speak to this better than I can. But my understanding is that, again, the whole point here is to provide a comprehensive picture for the state about what pesticide use is. And prior to the implementation of this program, that information that was being collected wasn't collected in a comprehensive way that could provide that kind of a picture. So.
Thank you. And is, Mr. Chair, is someone from the department speaking? Thank you. I'll ask.
I don't have anybody signed up at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe on another list. The deputy director or something. I have a question because, and you testified on, I think it's Representative Close's bill that would put off the implementation date. At that time, I believe you testified against that also. Mm-hmm. Is that still your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think we, again, Chair Gilman, members of the committee, we really feel strongly that we need to go forward and implement this program now, that any more delays are going to further frustrate people who are trying to report on this system. I think, again, a lot of what we're hearing in this testimony and others is that people are frustrated about the stop-and-go nature of this program and the fact that it's not up on and running with the capacity that's supposed to make it easy for folks. And so any kind of delay, any kind of cutbacks to this type of program is going to cause more frustration, not less. So we need to be looking at how can we go forward with this program in the most expeditious way possible.
Other questions?
Yes. Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, is your sense then that if we actually move toward full implementation or fuller implementation, that the very legitimate concerns related to difficulty with technology, difficult with kind of the volume of hours to comply, that many of those concerns would be addressed through implementation?
I believe so. Again, I can't speak to the constituent who was saying that they were spending 400 to 500 hours to comply with the program. I must say that seems a little high to me right off the bat. And obviously there'd be concerns if that was the standard for a one or two person operation, but it seems hard to me that that's the case. That said, you know, again, you can look to California as an example of how this has worked proactively for folks. You know, they've had that similar program like this for 13 years, and we've really seen the development of private companies be able to come up with cheap, cost-effective software that people can use to do this kind of reporting. And people, in fact, in the business community have found that this is something that has aided them in their production and allowed them to track their pesticides more closely, cut their costs, and really work with consumers better. And the hope is that that same type of benefits will accrue here in Oregon.
Further questions?
If I could actually, yes, just for the sake of the record, I think the letter you referenced that you handed out was actually from Ken Bailey.
Sorry, yeah, Ken Bailey.
Make sure that was clear for the record.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Glenn Stonebrick from Oregon Cattlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink, the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this bill I'll also be representing the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. Before I get into the full testimony, I just wanted to make a comment about the previous testimony and that it would be good for business in agriculture, Oregon, and talk about marketing Oregon products, a niche market. I understand where they're going with this, that this is if you don't use pesticides and you have this organically grown product, and that makes the rest of our producers look kind of like four-step children, but that's for another bill at another time. We support this bill, and we urge that you also vote in favor of it. Pesticide usage is everywhere, and it has brought about some wonderful things for production of food and forest products and aesthetic involvements around your homes and gardens, and obviously for controlling some very deadly disease and other pests for concerning human health. The reporting of the usage of pesticides has never been demonstrated as having a constructive value other than what was in the law before this pesticide use reporting bill was passed 4 years ago. I've talked to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and they do have data of people who have reported thus far. And I asked, what's that being used for? Is it being used? In fact, is it, and they'll testify later. You can ask them this, of course. It just sits there. So if, in fact, there is some real value, I mean, basically I'm saying there's no value for this new reporting system over and above what we had. But if, in fact, there is some real value, I'm assuming there'll be those who will say that there is some real value to having this, then why is it that we just have this bill for a select group of people that have to report? And if we could change the pesticide use reporting so everyone reports, every housewife, every gardener at the school, I mean everywhere, then we would have more than just some value. We'd have overwhelming value. And, of course, I think we know the answer to that is that if everyone had to report on every pesticide that's used, it would be too much of an overwhelming burden on the entire public, and then there would be outrage. So my point, of course, is that this should not be just on a certain group. I mean, this shows bias and prejudice, in my case, against the farmers and ranchers. And it's become a very costly burden to the Department of Agriculture. And again, from what I can see, is for no good reason. The only reason that I know of that this bill was passed 4 years ago was basically out of fear of what the proponents of the pesticide use reporting groups would do is to produce a ballot measure that would be even worse. In other words, we'll hang ourselves with a soft rope instead of a rough rope. So if we're to suffer the nightmares of having to report use of pesticides, then everyone must suffer. And or you could pass this bill and go back to the old law. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Glenn, there's a lot of folks in the farming community, a lot of my fellow farmers, who feel very, very much the way you do in terms of that this legislation as it currently, or the law as it currently structured, that was passed in 99, does in many ways bias and show extreme prejudice against natural resource industries. If we were to, and at some point in time, make this concept all-inclusive, this kind of gets to the debate, actually, of another bill that we have in regards to how would you report that. In your mind, what would we've talked about? We have township and range reporting today. Some people have suggested watershed. Some people have suggested zip codes. So, if we were going to get at that issue of how would we really make that work for everyone, in your mind, what would be the way to make a reporting system viable in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, if we were going to make that work, if that's what we have to live with, I think it would be as simple as, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, I live at, which of course my address is a zip code, and I used this much of so-called pesticide, name and type, quantity, last year. You could do it on a postcard. You could do it on some format that could be even scanned if you wanted to have it, but not the miles and, you know, the tons of paperwork and having to do it by, I mean, a lot of our people, believe it or not, still don't have computers. And some of them live very remotely on an old farmer phone line that doesn't always even work all the time in some of the remote areas where make it extremely simple and then put them out, you know, tons of data up there. And I don't know what for, but make somebody happy.
Okay. Representative Beyer.
I'm really annoying today. Thank you for being here. I will only ask two questions today.
I can never imagine you being annoying,
actually,
Representative, but you can try.
And it should not leave.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, maybe I should go back and start reviewing tapes when I do.
I have a couple questions. One is, we're being told how well the law is working in California, how successful it's been, and I'm sure all industries talk among each other. Do you know of any concerns that have been raised in your industries in other states regarding these kind of laws? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I do not have firsthand knowledge from, you know, individual producers. But I guess success is all in the eyes of the beholder. What is success? What have we accomplished? And I'm not trying to be facetious. I just think we should have some goals that we're going to do this for some particular reason that's going to benefit the general public and without being too onerous on the people that have to achieve it.
And the other question,
sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talk here about the fact that the only reason that this was implemented last time was because you were concerned about an initiative out there that could be a lot worse. Doesn't it concern you that if we were to do this now, that could happen again, or would most likely happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the ballot measure, the referendum process is out there at all times, which could take place to be even more onerous if that happens. We have no control. I understand this was to appease, but again, maybe my analogy is a little crude, but about hanging ourselves with rope. But I think too often we do that, and we, whether we think it's right or wrong, we just do it out of fear. And I personally don't believe we should do it. I know there can be consequences to that. But I think the public is in these different ballot measures I've seen, especially in the last few years, the public is becoming more aware, and I think looking at costs and using more common sense and perhaps just emotions and those niceties things that we want but don't necessarily need.
Thank you. Can I have it real quick?
Sure.
See what I mean, Mr. Chair?
Now, you know, I need to separate the two of you because...
it's usually me. It's just so nice to share.
Please continue, Representative Beyer.
Do you see any benefit of going back to the table and trying to work something out with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, if this is could be used as a placeholder bill and there could be some negotiations to make it less onerous, there would certainly be some benefit from our side, from our way of thinking, rather than having a bill that, and I don't know whether the governor would veto it. I don't know if it would get passed both bodies or not. But anything that could be less than what we're living with would be a blessing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
All right, Chair would like to call Michael Heumann. Is that it? Did I say that correct, Michael?
Yes.
Thank you. Having a somewhat difficult to pronounce name, I always try to be sensitive to that. Welcome, Michael,
thank
for the
you
record.
Very much. Mr. Chairman Krupp and members of the committee, my name is Michael Heumann. I'm an epidemiologist, and I'm the manager of the Environmental and Occupational Epidemiology Section within the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 3102 because we believe that the pesticide use reporting will provide information that is critically needed to protect public health and to respond to public concerns about pesticide exposure. Staff in my office investigate all reports of possible pesticide poisoning as one of the functions of the Pesticide Analytical and Response Center, or PARC. You may know of the PARC board. And also through funding under a cooperative agreement with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. The Pesticide Analytical and Response Center is overseen, of course, by the Department of Agriculture, but it is administered out of my office. And the actions of the PARC board are to coordinate the efforts of eight different state agencies, including the Department of Human Services, to investigate and respond to cases of pesticide poisoning throughout the state of Oregon. During the years 2001 and 2002, the majority of pesticide poisoning cases in Oregon happened in urban areas, in and around our homes, our schools, and our offices, and not on our farms or our forests, as one might expect. While this fact is interesting, without further information gained from the pesticide use reporting system on patterns of pesticide use throughout the state of Oregon, it is not possible to know whether pesticide use in urban areas as compared to rural areas is more of a problem or less of a problem. Is there an increase in the rural areas over the urban areas? Is there are there particular problems with specific products or perhaps with how the products are being used? In the year 2002, there were 187 cases of pesticide poisoning here in Oregon that my staff investigated. There were another 190 cases that we looked at that we were able to confirm were not associated with pesticides, but we did investigate 187 cases. The pesticide use reporting system can help answer some very basic questions, such as, is that a little pesticide poisoning or is that a lot? What are the proportion of pesticide applications does this represent? Is this a lot of the applications, or is it only a minor proportion of these applications? Are applications of specific types of pesticides more likely to result in poisoning than others? And do these data suggest that we should work to change, perhaps, how pesticides are applied? Or should we be reassured that current application methods are adequately in place to protect the public's health? Without the pesticide use reporting system, I'm afraid we won't be able to answer these questions. What's important is to be able to gather the information on pesticide use so that we can compare it against reports that we receive about adverse effects from pesticides either in the environment that affect animals, including wildlife, or human beings. And it's impossible to answer these questions otherwise. And that hampers our ability both to address health risks, if those are needed, or to reassure the public, should that be the case. There's a great deal of public concern about health effects of pesticides. People are worried that exposure to pesticides might have caused health problems for them or for their loved ones. And many Oregonians are concerned about the link between possible pesticide exposure and, say, cancer or neurological problems, or birth defects and miscarriages. While some of these concerns may well be borne out, others result from an absence of information, not from an overage of information. So without accurate data about pesticide use in Oregon, as would be obtained through the pesticide use reporting system, it is extremely difficult to respond effectively to these concerns and to help the public and policymakers sort out the problems that merit attention from those that can be put to rest. In summary, the Department of Human Services opposes this bill and would remove a valuable tool that helps better protect the public health and to respond to the extensive public concern about the health effects of pesticide exposure. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Michael, thank you. Wow. And I say wow because you make, in your second paragraph on your first page, a rather profound statement. In that, you say, during 2001 and 2002, Is that for two calendar years that you're saying the majority of pesticide poisoning are in urban areas?
Yes, Representative Croft and committee members, that is indeed the case. Oh. We've been tracking pesticide poisoning cases since pesticide poisoning became a reportable condition in 1985. And indeed, during the most recent years, probably the last 6 years, we have found a greater number of cases of adverse health effects from pesticides and frank poisonings in urban areas and not in either agricultural or forestry industries.
So that's in the last 6 years that you've been noticing that trend.
Yes, that's correct. And we don't know whether that means that the training of people who apply pesticides for a living is so good that there are no problems in forestry and agriculture, and perhaps the training of home users and people who are using chemicals in urban areas are less well trained, or maybe it has to do with the sheer volume of products that are being used. But without the reporting system, we can't answer that yet for sure.
Like, as a farmer who holds a restricted pesticide use license, I can assure you the training is fairly extensive and is necessary to be maintained on a regular basis, of which I think I'm lapsing now as we talk. So I guess I'm going to have to go back and spend those hours in the classroom again. I wanted to clarify one last thing that you said on your second page. You said there were 187 cases that were investigated by PARC, but you said there was 190 that were reported as pesticide poisoning, but it turns out they weren't?
Mr. Chair and committee members, beyond the 187 cases that we logged in that actually met our criteria as cases, we had another 190 calls beyond that of people who were concerned about pesticides as being an issue, and our initial assessment and investigation was able to help them rule out pesticides, that there was either not enough information or that we could help them find another cause to to their concern, their symptoms.
Okay. So, and one last question I want to ask you. That's about 50%, 187, 190. So, has that been a normal statistical analysis? Have about half, over the last 6 years, have you seen the urban cases being reported that you've investigated? Is that about normal to have half, or has it been changing?
Actually, Representative Cropper, Mr. Chair, and committee members, we have actually not tracked the cases that we call potential cases until the last 2 or 3 years, because we've not had the resources to do that. And so we can't say that for sure. We do know, though, that the number of the 187 cases that came to us represents quite a large jump in cases over previous years. So we are seeing an increase in actual pesticide poisoning cases.
I see. Members?
Representative.
Okay, you guys are trading off now. All right, so we've got this down.
Is it Dr. Human?
No, just Mr. Human.
Mr. Human, thank you for being here. I don't know who does your reports on disease control in that division. Do you do those?
Mr. Chair and committee members and Representative Nelson, I'm part of the team that does the reporting on various diseases. The area in which I work is in occupational and environmental diseases, and we have other staff members who work in acute and communicable or infectious diseases. So if you're talking about our current disease summary, the yellow report that comes that every other week. I do some of those, and others do those as well.
Well, they're excellent, and I just wanted to thank you. I have every one of them.
Thank you.
And so I tracked that, and I kept it for, I don't know how long y'all been doing it, but I just think that's very important. And we have something new that comes out, like this new whatever, makes you, I bet you might see it on your list before you see it on the World Health, and I'm proud of y'all. Here's my concern. Dear goodness, you know, on every one of these products, there are, you know, very detailed rules for using these products. And I guess I have a concern of how far do we need to go you know, I mean, I don't think we can police every single person, you know, to see if they do exactly what a container says. So based on your studies, I would hate for y'all to, I mean, what it appears to me to be is that we need some just general education rather than reporting, it appears to me, for all these people who are using this, you know, in their households, in their yard. In fact, this very day I was trying to figure out how I could kill some stuff. And I hate to tell you, not people.
Thanks for that important distinction, Representative.
Yes. I don't even want to tell you what it is. Don't you think that we could, instead of just, you know, adding more reporting, that we could have some general education for us? I mean, because it appears that's where we need it. Coming from a former ag community, I mean, I know how detailed we were in our reporting and what we used. And, I mean, we have to, or we wouldn't be a business. Number one, we'd ruin our own land, and we'd ruin, you know, our relationships with every neighbor and so forth. So I think we're going to do that, and we wouldn't be taking care of our habitats appropriately. But don't you think that the real need is just having general education so people can understand, you know, the dangers of Roundup or, you know, whatever else we're going to be using? I'm not sure that's the right product, but I'm just using that for an example.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I appreciate the question very much. Certainly there is detailed instructions and regulations around the use of every single pesticide product, as you mentioned. There are strict guidelines as to how much it should be diluted and at what rate it should be applied. And certainly, as the chairman mentioned, licensed applicators must go through and periodic recertification to be well educated on how to use those products. And without a doubt, all licensed applicators that I am familiar with in Oregon do a very good job of that. Certainly, education is one component of what we need. However, in addition to that, while we like to think that we're working with science here, there is a bit of art of the marketing of pesticide products, and oftentimes when a new product is released or many products are released, we don't necessarily know how toxic they could be even at the recommended levels, and it's only by doing the surveillance that we're able to try to differentiate between, if you will, lack of education that some people have when they misuse a product in their home or in their garden, versus an inherent problem with the product that needs to be changed, where the labeling needs to be changed, or even the use needs to be changed. If I could give you a quick example of that, a few years ago, the Park Board, and through our tracking of cases, identified a problem in many people's homes. They would go out and get paint for their home, their bathroom or their bedroom, and they didn't want to have mold or mildew inside the house, so what they would do is they would have the paint shop put in a little teeny vial of liquid into that paint as a mildew aside, a product that would kill mildew. Well, it turns out that nobody bothered to read that label very well because it was written in such small type, but you weren't supposed to mix that for indoor paint. It was supposed to be for outdoor paint, and so lots of homes were using it indoors, and we started seeing numbers of cases. And so what happened there is it was one of these issues where it was kind of fell between the cracks until we identified it by tracking these cases and identifying that there was this problem. And it wasn't homeowners who were doing it. It was more the sellers of the paint products. And so we then, through seeing this and through tracking it, worked with both them and with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Agriculture to get a label change that specifically prohibited the use of that chemical indoors in paint. In other words, it was okay to use in paint, but we needed to make sure that they didn't use it indoors. So there's only that tracking. The other piece, to answer your question, is that without understanding how pesticides are being used, it's hard to respond to concerned citizens or others as to what the magnitude of the problem is. But being able to put these numbers of cases into perspective in terms of numbers of applications or pounds of application and throughout the year and throughout the state, we'll be in a much better position to be able to talk about if there are real problems or if they are just perceptions. Does that help answer it? I don't know. It was a long answer.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll follow up.
Quickly, please.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Well, I guess I'm just saying I don't ever see, I mean, I don't know how,
let's say, it's our responsibility to police every household and every farmer and every individual, you know. I'm just saying, it appears to me that educational programs, which I never see any of on this subject, would be a far better measure of explaining what could possibly occur with the use of a pesticide used incorrectly than, you know, knocking on every door and looking under my kitchen sink, you know. I guess I'm just trying to say, you know, where's the money best spent? And I think it would be best spent in education. Thank you.
Hear, hear, Representative. That's an excellent point. And I have to say that I think that it has worked well, again, as a practitioner of the art, as a farmer. It clearly, I mean, years ago when my dad was applying chemicals and herbicides, when I was very young, we didn't take the precautions that we do today. And I think that comes through the educational component and the analyzing of the issues. And I think that really brings up a good point, because if we're having obviously problems in the urban areas with pesticide poisoning and that's increasing, then we need to find out why. And that's why I think there's value personally in pesticide use reporting. But I think it also clearly tells us that there needs to be some maybe educational component that would help those homeowners avoid the opportunity to be poisoned, number one, and proper usage. And those are good ideas.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there's definitely room for and need for both of those. The reporting can help us target the education that needs to be done. It can help us point out which areas are having more problems than other areas, so that education could be targeted. And I think that the two go hand in hand. I think the point that you're making, Mr. Chair, is an excellent one, that indeed the reporting will lead the way for what it is that we need to do the education. The other thing, I don't want to leave you with the impression that it is only homeowners and people who are unlicensed who are involved in the exposures that lead to health problems. There are also applications by licensed applicators that do lead to illness. And so all the tracking is important and the education is both important. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Michael. Members, I want to give this issue about another 15 minutes. We have three more witnesses, and then we'd like to move on to a couple other important issues. And thank you, Representative. Chair, I'd like to call Jim Myron from the Governor's Office. Jim, come forward if you would, please. Welcome. Good to see you again.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Myron with the Governor's Office. And I appreciate the opportunity to present a brief statement today on behalf of the governor. The governor does see the pesticide use reporting system as an important component of potential future marketing of agricultural products in Oregon. And he also sees it as an important component in environmental protection efforts in the state. The governor supports full funding for the program, and we do need to resolve any issues relative to the implementation of the program. And so to the extent that that this debate uncovers those problems, we need to address those and figure out how to resolve those. But the governor does not support the elimination of the program. And I have spoken with the sponsor of the bill, and he's given me some information about the gentleman that that is having the problems with the reporting system. And I've asked the Department of Agriculture to contact that gentleman and see if we can resolve his problems within the context of the current program. And we're more than happy to work with them to do that. So with that, I'll just close and ask if there are any questions.
Thank you, Jim. Yes, we have a couple down here. Representative Beyer first, and then Representative Nelson. The dynamic duo. We're at it again.
One of my questions I asked before was whether there was any benefit to going back to the table to discuss that. And would the governor's office be interested in, because it sounds to me almost like it's more the implementation issue over and over again and how onerous the process is. But Is the governor's office willing to go back to the table with people, or just?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, it seems like that's what we do best in this process is talk about things. So I can't say no, we won't talk about it. You know, like I said, if there are implementation problems and if there are changes that need to be made to resolve those, we're certainly not opposed to resolving those. But the I'll just be honest with you. The biggest challenge for this program is to find the general fund revenues necessary to continue the program. That's the real challenge.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, you're next.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, nice to meet you. I just wonder if you would be so kind to talk to the governor about the education program. Just coming from a user, sound like a drug addict, a user, I just want to tell you how important I think that is, because I think we're talking for an overall purpose for the state, and we seem here to just want to target one area, which I think is, you know, a little ridiculous. And I just think, respectfully, I just suggest an education program is what we need with the monies we have.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, we will have that discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. And not to be discriminatory against the dynamic duo on my left over here, Representative Gilman, you have a question.
You say that the governor would like to support the funding. My question is, and because this is a debate we're having, is figuring out how to make the pesticide reporting bill functional more important than K-12 education?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, I'm not prepared to answer that question. That is obviously at the heart of a lot of the discussions that are occurring in this building, and I don't have an answer for you on that one.
Well, thank you, Jim, for your candidness on that. I appreciate that. And I do appreciate the fact the governor is willing to look seriously at resolving some of the problems and the issues that do resolve and clearly have come up and I think need to be attended to. I think you're right to some extent. The greatest issue that faces us is the amount of money that's necessary to bring the program to the next level of usability. And I think it's important. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. All right. Chair, I'd like to call Chuck Craig and Lisa Hansen from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Chuck, it's good to see you, even if you are on crutches. And I hope that isn't because we were beating up on you recently.
I've been to a rough hearing.
Yeah. Sympathy works, though. Welcome to you both, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the Department of Ag. And with me is Lisa Hansen, one of our assistant directors. And Lisa has had the distinction of overseeing the development of the pesticide use reporting system over the last
few years.
Mr. Chair, we're here primarily to try to answer questions that we might be the ones who can answer. However, I have to tell you that we do not support this bill for a couple of reasons, one being that the governor does want the program to go forward and wants to find the funding for it. And secondly, we have participated in discussions with the stakeholders trying to find a solution, a compromise solution that would enable the program to go forward in some fashion, resolving the current dilemma we faced. And I don't see how we could come in and support a bill to eliminate it when we've been participating in those discussions in good faith. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think we'd I'd like to just make one more comment, and then perhaps we could answer some questions that the committee that might have come up that the committee would like us to. With reference to public education, we have proposed a number of times to have positions in our agency that were outreach positions, specifically to provide educational outreach to the private homeowner type user, and we've never been able to get those funded.
Okay. I've got Representative Gilman first and then Representative Beyer.
We've talked a little bit about the risks, and I'm wondering if there's any way, or if you've looked at with these discussions you've had, if there's any way of involving those purchases by individuals and homeowners in a pesticide reporting system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, Lisa Hansen can address that in more detail, but we do have a homeowner survey underway right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current law...
State who you are.
Oh, for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. I'm sorry. Members of the committee, one of the components of the law says that a retail sales reporting mechanism could be put in place, and that was proposed by the department during the 2001 legislature as part of the pesticide use reporting system. That was not funded by the legislature during that time frame. The current system that's in place has the component that people refer to as the reporting system, which is a database that collects information on all categories of pesticide use that are applied by people using pesticides in the course of doing business. And then there, to overlay with that, there is a component that we refer to as the household use survey that should capture information about pesticides used by homeowners.
Thank you. Can I be brief? But one of the things this discussion has brought out, and I think all our discussions on this particular bill has brought out, is the lack of funding and how onerous the actual reporting in are. And what was mentioned, and I know you were here, was the fact that these, you know, the records keeping and the reporting are just two separate entities. And I kind of wanted to get an idea from you whether you thought that was true. And are you working on trying to meld them together so that they aren't as much of a hardship?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the requirements for the pesticide use reporting system, as was stated previously, were set specifically for this system. The requirements for record keeping for commercial applicators are set in statute, but they're also part of the Food Quality Protection Act that was passed in 1990, which is a federal regulation. In other states where there are systems that are somewhat similar to this, after their reporting system has been up for some period of time, they have looked at melding those together. But our system has not gotten off the ground far enough to be able to really have those discussions. We don't even have the permanent system completely developed yet.
Thank you.
Further questions? Lisa, I think you appeared before a Farm Bureau meeting in Jackson County that I was in attendance. And I want to express to you that you did an excellent job of presenting a not very well accepted topic.
Thank you.
I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, I'd like to call Terry Witt from OFS. Welcome, Terry, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and I apologize for not getting my name on the list sooner, but I was not planning on testifying. However, hearing some of the previous testimony, I was inspired to at least say a few words to perhaps set the record straight. We do understand the frustration that Representative Crumble put forth, particularly talking about one of his constituents that is in the pest control business. I think what has not been mentioned by the department is that the system right now is broke. Broke from a money perspective and broke from a realistic perspective, because it's a temporary system incapable of handling data as it should if it were a permanent system. And that's what's creating a tremendous amount of the anxiety and the frustration for the people who are trying to input data. With regard to a comment that was made that questioned the accuracy of 500 hours of input data, during the task force that looked at putting this together, we had one of our own members who has a pest control operation in the city of Eugene put together a estimate based upon actual filing of reports as to what it would take his business to report according to the criteria outlined. His estimate for his business was 1,200 hours, not 500. So 500 hours for a pest control business is a reasonable amount of time. When you consider that a pest control company, a moderately sized pest control company, will do 30,000 applications in a year, figure that out in terms of reporting, and I think you can see that 500 to 1,000 hours of reporting time is not an overly exaggerated figure. PERS was, I think, intended to be a program that would tell us where materials were being used, give us an idea as to developing and shaping our monitoring so that we could ensure that we were not having adverse effects on the environment, but it was never intended to be the end-all for all concerned. And that includes doing things like epidemiology studies through the health division. And I guess I was very, very glad to hear Mike Heumann extol the virtues of the PARC system and what a great program that is, because that system currently is unfunded. It is not funded in the current budget because of the reduction, and I believe that's a $200,000 budget item. Those are the kind of decisions that I think we have to make, and I think Representative Gilman was right on target. Not just education, but here's a program, PARC program, that has been in progress or in established for over 10 years. Very, very worthwhile program that right now is on the verge of being eliminated because there is a lack of funds. So we have to weigh these programs, and here's one that gives real data about real perceived and reported cases of pesticide impact. So I think it's not just a matter of do we support a pesticide program or do we not. I think we have to even look at it closer than that and say which pesticide programs do we support. To that end, I guess I would also challenge some of these other departments, like the Health Division, Department of Environmental Quality, and maybe even the environmental community, as to coming up with some innovative ways of perhaps coming up with some revenue, because this program is not shared in terms of funding by any of those divisions or departments. So I guess I would just say that we would like to see a solution found. We think that there is merit to the program. But the program right now is broke. It has very significant problems, and one of those problems was created by the rulemaking process itself. When the recommendations of the work group were put together, the department then put together a rule package that went out for public comment. Public comment was received throughout the state. I believe we had seven hearings across the state. The hearings officer put together the report, submitted it to the Department of Agriculture. They agreed with the hearings officer's report. The report was adopted by the Board of Agriculture, but the governor at that time, John Kitzhaber, used his weight and changed the recommendations in the rule package, and that alone has created probably more animosity than more conflict among the user community and the department over this particular program than probably any one single item that has occurred. So I guess in closing, we kind of side with the Department of Agriculture and the fact that we find it difficult to support abolishing the program at this point in time because we haven't lost faith in it, but it sure needs to be fixed. And when it comes to balancing needs like PARC versus a program that has not even been fully implemented, we seriously question pulling general fund dollars and supporting this program right now to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Questions? Appreciate it, Terry. Thanks. This concludes our public hearing on House Bill 3102 for the moment. Thank you all for coming. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3026. And Ray, would you tell us what this bill is about as Representative Shetterly comes forward?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3026 eliminates the requirement that counties be of a certain size to abolish county fair boards. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 565.210 provides that any county may hold county and industrial fairs, but only one county fair shall be held in each county. Subsequently, 565.265 grants county courts authority to abolish county fair boards in counties having populations between 400 and 600,000, according to their most recent annual estimate of population. Accordingly, county fair boards may be replaced with fair districts or fair associations. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Representative Shetterly, welcome. And why are we doing this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23. This bill comes to us, you'll hear from Ray Steele, our former sheriff in Polk County and a Polk County farmer and a longtime friend of the Polk County Fair and on the Fair Board. Very interesting statute here that we have that number one says you're only going to have one county fair, that is in each county. And then also says that gives you this statute, ORS 565.265, that is in the bill, that gives you gives the county the ability to abolish a county fair board. Obviously, that's a first step toward creating a fair district or fair association or some other way of funding and sponsoring a county fair. But if you look in Section 7 of the existing statute, it limits the application of this statute to counties having a population exceeding 400,000 but not exceeding 600,000. This is a way of defining Washington County. Washington County is the only county that has the ability under this bill to abolish the fair board and to go then to some other means of funding and sponsoring and operating a county fair. So in Polk County's case and the case of every other county, they don't have that option, that flexibility to go to some other means of operating the fair. This began with a memorandum I received a copy of from Polk County Legal Counsel that said simply that the state statute does not authorize Polk County to initiate proceedings to abolish the county fair board. The critical section is ORS 565.265 sub 7, which expressly provides that in order to proceed with steps to abolish the county fair board and replace it with a fair district, the county must have a population of $400,000 to $600,000. And then in brackets, and the language that really gets us here today, this population limitation makes no sense on its face. Polk County may wish to propose a legislative fix. So that is why we have the bill before you today, to give counties flexibility in how they address the governance of county fairs and to give counties other than Washington County the same opportunity that Washington County presently has under statute to abolish the fair board and go to some other vehicle, some other mechanism. It still would obviously remain then a decision for the local counties to decide what's best for their particular counties. But at this point, they're constrained by state statute and don't even have the ability to address that question. Again, you have our former Sheriff Steele here to talk to you in particular about that, but I'm pleased to answer any questions if you have them on my bare little bit of knowledge about this. Otherwise, I'll be pleased to have Mr. Steele come forward.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you. And maybe I should wait, but what would be the difference between a fair board and a fair district?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Beyer, I think what you'll find is it's mostly how they how they're funded. County Fair Board is going to be funded by appropriation through the County General Fund budget, primarily. A fair district would have authority to impose a property tax to support the operation of the county fair. I think that's probably going to be your principal distinction between the two.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shirley, does this mean if we was no longer under a county fair board, would Yamhill County, for example, fair still be able to receive state money? If it were under association, we receive money now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nelson, I think that really depends on how the state appropriates. I'm not sure if the state distinguishes at this point between Washington County and other counties. That's a good question, perhaps either for staff to follow up on, or maybe Mr. Steele knows. But I think ultimately that's going to determine on a biennium to biennium basis according to how the state chooses to allocate funds to county fairs.
Sorry.
Well,
okay.
Well, go ahead. Finish.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, just a last question, I promise. I just have a concern, Mr. Chair, Representative Shirley. The mandatory requirement, as I understand, for a county fair is one event a year. One county fair, and I thought that was under statute.
Nelson, I don't know if that's under statute. That certainly is custom if it's not under statute, yeah.
So I'm assuming that if we remove this from the county fair board is removed, basically we would be eliminating county fairs from any jurisdiction of the state and restore local control in any form the county should determine
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I guess county fairs would continue to be creatures of county government. This gives counties more flexibility in how they want to create. I mean, as it is now, again, your county fairs are creatures of the general fund of the county. This gives the county the ability to create a local fair district if they want to, but that will still be a local fair district, just as county fairs are under the governance now of local county commissions. This just gives counties more flexibility to determine under their local circumstances what kind of organizational structure they want to operate their county fair. This isn't really an issue between state control or local control of counties. They're under local control, and they would remain under local control under this bill. This just, again, creates more options for the organization of county fairs at the discretion of the county commissions.
And maybe to answer a little bit further, Ray, why don't you, Chair, I'd like to call Ray Steele to come forward. Ray, because I noticed Ray was shaking his head yes and no.
Yeah,
to,
right.
And so I thought I might call him forward to bail Representative Shetterly out.
That's safe, Chair.
Welcome, Ray, and for the record, state your name. And why don't you address that question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Krupp. Ray Steele, I'm present chairman of the Polk County Fair Board. And I suppose I ought to have, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson restate the question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Steele, thank you for being here. I'm just trying to determine why this is in a state statute at this time when it's a county issue. So I guess that's where my thinking came about. And I'm assuming that this should principally read this is a financial event that we're planning for. Versus policy of governance.
It's as explained to us by Polk County's legal counsel, it's more a one of financing because all we're doing by eliminating that population limit is allowing all 36 counties instead of one of 36 to make a decision that must be in concert with the Polk County Board or any Board of Commissioners and the Fair Board, which has to appoint an advisory committee of three each. So each board would appoint three. That advisory committee then would meet and make a recommendation to the Board of Commissioners. The Board of Commissioners, for example, if it came to abolish the Fair Board, then the Polk County Commissioners in our circumstance would then hold public hearings saying that they would be abolishing the Fair Board, and I'll check my notes here, but I got that sort of spelled out here. back of them on the commissioners with that input from that advisory board then would make a resolution. And that resolution would go to public hearings within that county. And from the conclusion of the public hearings, the Board of Commissioners then would make a ruling, abolish or not to abolish. If they chose to abolish the Fair Board, then what they would do, they would have to declare we are going to either have a fair association or form a fair district that would manage and operate the local fair. As far as the remainder of that ORS, 565 or whatever.
565.
Yeah, 565.
That's correct.
Would remain in effect, and so, again, relying on the advice of our county council, is that you still could only hold one fair. It would be just how we obtain the money. You would no longer have an appointed fair board. You'd have an elected fair board. And it would be able to set its own, I guess you'd call it, taxing district. And that would be the main difference.
Okay. Steve Byer.
Back to my original question.
That's right. Here we are. Full circle.
I've got the differences. Would that a fair district preclude you from taking county appropriations? Would that just make you separate? And then if you wanted to try to get county money, you'd have to go to them to do it?
Yeah, we would not be able to take county appropriations, no. We would be on our own with our own taxing district.
Thank you.
Simple
corporation
of the state. Okay.
The reason that this came up is last fall, the county commission and our fair board were meeting to discuss how to find funding for our fair. We chose to go to a fair district, and suddenly legal counsel for the county says, time out, folks. You can't do that because of this population. And hence, here we are today, because we felt that every county's citizens should have the ability to go to their county commissions and talk with them about how they should manage and organize and operate their fair if they so choose. And so that's what brought us here today.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think what really is at the root of this is declining county budgets and the declining ability of counties to support county fairs out of their general fund revenues. And I would also suppose at least the problematic future of continued state funding. That's always been a battle, as the chair knows, in the years that we've served together. And as the budget gets tighter and tighter as we go forward, I think both of those areas or avenues of support are at least becoming more and more problematic, which is why I think you have counties looking at the propriety of establishing fair districts to shift the funding to a property tax base that is going to be more stable, assuming then that it has local support to create such a fair district. So that's what this is really at root. That's what it's all about, level of funding and sustainability for county fairs.
Final question, Mr. Chair. Representative Shirley and Mr. Steele? Is that right?
Yes.
I guess I'm just trying to understand. I'm just going to liken this to I don't know what, in our county. The sheriff's department stands alone, but yet they receive funding. I mean, they're not under the rule of the commissioners. This is an elected official. However, they receive funding. I guess I'm just trying to find out, you know, who rules this. And if we're going to do this, why don't we just take county fairs out of any jurisdiction by the state and let them stand alone as park districts or water and light districts? Or that's not good either, is it? Because those are under cities.
Well, maybe.
How do we get them free?
Well, maybe Ray can partially shed some light on that by explaining to us the structure of the statute.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. There's a couple of questions that can be answered. The first one to answer is Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 565.210, do not require the counties hold county or industrial fairs. What the statute says is they may hold county industrial fairs. If they do, then there may be only one per county. So the only prohibition in that part of the statute is from, let's say, Washington County, for example, if notwithstanding the population, but if you have a county fair in Hillsborough, you can't go to a different part of Washington County and have a county fair in the same year over in that other part of the county. Having said that, if a county uses the option of not to hold a county fair, then there is a statute, or revised statute 565.310, which calls for the disbursement of funds in case county fairs are not held. As far as the special district goes, if notwithstanding the population prohibition, which really is what stops counties from going to special districts, as Representative Nelson is referencing, at least from the way I read the statute, the district is would be like a park district. There are specific requirements of a district within the statute, the election, the makeup, and so forth. But what that does is it takes the funding mechanism out of the county general fund, puts it into a special district, which in our minds would be the equivalent, let's say, a regional library district. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the individual district becomes a municipal corporation of the state, separate and distinct from other government entities, and has the ability to levy taxes. It also has the ability to own property and distribute property if there is ever a dissolution of that municipal corporation, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, that helps, I think, explain that a little better in terms of the structure. So by helping me be clear on this, so if we pass this legislation and the Fair Board decides to become a district, then the state money goes away. County general fund goes away, correct?
Mr. Chair.
Or could it still come to you as a district?
I think it traditionally doesn't. No, but I mean, when you have the city of Portland imposing a tax and then making an appropriation to the school district, I don't think there's anything in statute
that would prohibit. Okay.
Just would not be a resident part of the county general fund. It would take some special appropriation like that, and probably not likely, because I think what counties are trying to do is, if they're going this direction, is to move it out of the general fund because they're having trouble keeping up funding anyway.
But that gives you the ability then to make the argument that we could add it to the property tax rolls in terms of the stable funding source. Is that inside or outside of Measure 5 caps?
Mr. Chair, that would be within the $10.
It would be within the $10 cap.
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then, Representative Shirley, would you be willing to, Mr. Steele, be willing to amend this to also remove us from those regulations? Because, for example, in my district, I have 11 cities in Yamhill County. It would be nice. I mean, it would be wonderful if we could have, you know, four county fairs. I have continuously, you know, sought to get cities to sponsor one building at our fair, and then we'd all be so happy. But I don't see that happening because our communities like themselves. I mean, they like the way they do things there. So, but in order for me to be able to have a north, south, east, and west in my county fair, I cannot do it, even though I'm now financed by the entire county.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond, Representative Nelson, certainly the bill is in your possession. That goes well beyond the narrow purpose of why we put that in. And I'm not sure that the relating clause gets you there. It's relating to county fair boards.
Oh.
So I'm not sure that this bill gives you the vehicle to be able to do that more expansive renovation.
Well, I would agree.
Yeah, too bad. Okay,
any additional questions? Any further thoughts you'd like to share with either one of you?
No, I mean, thank you for taking the time to hear us and allow us to give the testimony.
One question for me. Is there any opposition?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I've not heard of any.
Okay.
We have not either. We have taken this to the Oregon Fairs Association Board presented it to them, and they do not oppose us trying to eliminate the population control mechanism.
Okay. I didn't see John McCauley in the audience, so I assumed that it was probably okay.
Yes.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you both very much.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask what cities are in Washington County?
Well, we'd have to get a map to properly ascertain
that. Is that the Hillsborough-Beaverton area?
Yeah, it is.
And it has more people than Multnomah?
It's between the two, actually. It's between the 400 and 600,000.
Hey, but Multnomah doesn't have a county fair?
Mr. Chair, the population of Multnomah County exceeds 600,000, therefore it is not subject.
Oh, it's just between the two. I see what
right.
you're saying.
Right.
Is this strange?
Allow the chair to take an informal poll, and I'll tell you why. We need to kill a little time here. In the broadcasting business, we call that dead air. We have the Dogami fee bill, which we would like to pass out. However, our two friends in the audience that are working together on this, we needed a last moment, very small amendment, and it's being done for us as we speak. So we're probably going to run right up to the 3 o'clock time frame to vote out this fee bill, and I really would like to get it down to Ways and Means at this time. As they're now working through the budget process, they want to have an opportunity to start massaging it. So at any rate, we need to be here for another 15 minutes, even though we probably could conclude more quickly because of that issue. So, in the meantime, I thought I would... Yes, Representative Hunt.
Is there a reason that we couldn't move to a work session on the bill we just heard?
Well, I'm not sure that there is any good reason not to, and I thought I would just informally discuss with members of the committee how do you feel about moving forward on... hang on one moment. Okay. We're going to take an informal recess.
Okay. We are reconvened after a short recess. The chair would entertain a motion to adopt House Bill 3026. That's great timing, Representative Smith. Glad to have you back.
You're welcome.
Representative Hunt?
Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 3026 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. It has been moved, House Bill 3026, to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? It seems like we beat this pretty well to death at this point in time. Representative Smith, if you've just joined us, any comments on this particular issue? This is Representative Shetterly's bill at the request of the Polk County Fair Board. And basically this allows them the latitude to change from a fair board, from a county fair to a fair district, which allows them then the opportunity to petition their local folks for local property tax revenue to replace or augment state and county general fund. So it basically is flexibility at their request. So far, the members of the committee have indicated a willingness to move forward. So
thanks. Sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you.
If no further discussion, is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Brendan, thank you. House Bill 3026 is hereby passed to the full House for consideration with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Shetterly will be the carrier. David, so noted.
All right,
we're going to close a work session on 3026. Oh, by the way, I don't think I opened. Did I open a work session on 3026? We opened a work session on 3026. We closed a work session on 3026.
No, we got to open the work session and take the voting.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to open a work session on 3026.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 3026 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
So moved. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Representative Shetterly will be the carrier. We're going to close the work session, House Bill 3026. We're going to open a work session and public hearing and work session on House Bill 2256. We have two gentlemen in the audience. I'm going to call them both. Well, we have one gentleman in the audience. Well, there are more gentlemen in the audience, but we have one that, all right, after stepping on my tongue, inserting my size 10 out of my mouth, Gary, would you come forward, please? Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries.
We have an amendment to your fee bill, and you probably outsee that amendment, shouldn't you?
I certainly should, Mr. Chair. I think, but I think I know what it is.
Definitely, you're okay with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. And if Ray could, if you could see if Rich Angstrom's outside the door, have him come in real quick. Thank you. So if we take the printed bill and. We're going to add creating new provisions, or delete creating new provisions. And then on page 2, lines 32. Rich, come forward, please. Rich Angstrom. We have the amendments before us, Rich. So why don't you and Gary take a moment to peruse them to make sure that it does what you want it to do. Pages 3 through 5. Okay.
Page 3 through 5. Okay. And then page 1, line 2.
Thanks, Ray.
No problem, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's pretty much it.
Mr. Chair.
For the record, state your name.
My name is Rich Angstrom, the president of OCAFA. Before you are a set of amendments, Amendment Dash 1 is my guess here.
Rich, what does OCAPA stand for?
The Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. We're a construction materials association.
Thank you.
The amendments comply with the agreement that the industry has with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and looking through them, it appears all the quotations are in the right place, and the deleted sections are the right deleted sections.
Very nice.
Wait, I'm sure.
Recess.
Excuse me.
Kill the sound. We're going to reconvene.
Apologize.
And please continue.
That concludes mine.
Okay. Gary?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly live with that amendment and support it.
Okay, very good. Members, questions? Representative Nelson.
The purpose of the creating new provisions amendment, help me with that.
I believe that was all of the sections that we're deleting. We're deleting the bottom third of page 2, and all of the following pages are just going away. And since we're deleting those, we're also deleting the creating new provisions in the relating clause. Is that correct, Ray?
Mr. Chair, remind the committee that the relating clause always ends at the first punctuation mark, and all things afterward are informational. Creating new provisions is exactly as the chair had indicated. That speaks to the part of the bill that is being deleted. That's page 2, lines 32 through 45, and pages 3, 4, and 5, which leaves us with a measure that is amending Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 517.800 only. It no longer creates new provisions within the law.
And may I just ask, I do not think we could change relating clause.
We can't, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this is not changing the relating clause. The relating clause is related to mining fees only. It goes to the first punctuation mark within that statement. Everything else is informational from the legal standpoint. So this bill is relating to mining fees. Amending Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 517.800, which follows afterward, is only an informational issue. It is not the
relating
clause.
It is a part of the actual relating clause.
No.
Yeah. The actual relating clause, and I appreciate you restating that because I had absolutely forgotten that.
Okay.
Actually, it ends with that wherever you have a first punctuation mark.
Right.
I did not know
that.
Well, I've learned something.
Well, we all have because I'd forgotten.
Hey, I'm about with you now.
That's what we're here for, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
That's good stuff.
We were getting ready to vote on a bill we couldn't vote on because we couldn't change it that way. So.
Okay. Anything else to add, gentlemen? All right.
No,
thank you both very much. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2256 and open a work session on House Bill 2256. The chair would entertain a motion to adopt the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2256.
Okay. The motion is so made. Any discussion?
On the amendment.
On the amendment? Okay, no discussion on the amendment. Any objection to adopting the -1 amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. -1 amendment is hereby adopted to House Bill 2256. Representative Beyer, would you like to make a further motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. To Ways and Means.
Very, very good.
With a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Okay, members, House Bill 2256 has been motioned to be referred to the Ways and Means Subcommittee as amended with a due pass. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I'd just first like to comment. This has been one of our more invigorating agricultural meetings of the year, and I want to thank you for it.
very interesting subjects we've covered today. I just have to explain to you why I'm unable to support this bill. I come from the third poorest county in the state with a third most rapidly growing population. And we are just hand-to-mouth. And in my district are individuals who truly cannot afford an increase in fees and continue to employ the people they do employ. And we're at a position. I was discussing this yesterday with another businessman in kind of a similar industry yesterday, and basically what we're all just trying to do is keep people employed, period, in any form. And many employees are understanding and choosing not to have increases in salary or their usual raise, and in additional income in any way to keep everybody working they possibly can so they don't have to lay anybody else off. So I'm sure this is done with some good judgment, but I just am unable to on behalf of my industry.
Okay, thank you, Representative. I do appreciate that explanation.
President Hunt, your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really want to commend you for bringing this to us for a work session, and Dogami and Ocampo for bringing this forward. It's interesting because what I hear from business people in my district, far more than that, is the desire for streamlined, expeditious processing of permits and applications by governmental agencies. And I'm very excited about this bill because, as I understand it, it will actually give some specific resources to the agency that will allow that kind of timely processing of these applications. And so, even though we're not the Economic Development Committee, I think this is a great bill to move forward that really is about economic development and helping to streamline and move forward those permits. So I view this as a very pro-business opportunity for us, and appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative. Good to hear that. Any further comments? All right. The chair would also like to note that he shares similar sentiments with both Representative Hunt and Representative Nelson in both ways, and I'm somewhat torn on this particular piece of legislation. I do understand that this will help fund a position to help the industry deal with the implementation of the new 4D rules. That is a significant issue that has never been upon us before, because the 4D rules have only been in effect for, I think, only about a year or so now, or actually 4 years. They've been driven strongly through the courts to be implemented at the most basic level. And even though this position has been held vacant for a number of years, this fee bill will help fill that position so that it can be used for the purposes that Representative Hunt has just articulated. Now, having said that, I am not a big fan of increasing anybody's fees in this particular legislative session. And I'm going to render my courtesy vote to vote this down to Ways and Means Subcommittee, and I reserve the right to make the judgment to vote no on the floor on philosophical grounds. So having said that, we've had our discussion. Any further discussion? Hearing none, is there, we need to call the roll.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Worth.
Excused.
Representative Byard.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Thomas.
Courtesy aye. House Bill 2256, having met the constitutional requirements, hereby referred to the Ways and Means Subcommittee by prior reference as amended with a due pass. I'm going to close the work session on that. Members, one last thing before we conclude today's work. Representative Worth is not with us today because her father passed away last night at home. And what I would like us to do is send her family some flowers expressing our condolences, and then I will I'll take care of that myself, and then I'll ask you each to chip in on equal basis so that we can get that done. I think it's timely and appropriate. So with that, thank you all for very good work today, and we will see you all later. We are concluded for the day.